to the Quantum Feedback Loop podcast. I'm your host, James Myers, and I also publish The Quantum Record, which features the latest in science and technology. Over the past few years, I've seen several brief references to the human labor that goes into labeling images for machine learning and software applications. But until I spoke with Adio Danica, I didn't know anything about the working conditions for many thousands of people around the planet whose labor is critical to making the AI tools that we use every day. I also wasn't aware that there are no industry-wide standards for the fair treatment of these people, a great number of whom are working in the global south for wages that many of us in the global north couldn't imagine surviving on. Adio is a researcher for the Distributed AI Research Institute, or DARE. DARE was founded by Timnit Gebru after she was terminated by Google, where she was technical co-lead of the company's ethical artificial intelligence team. Now approaching its third anniversary, DARE's team is distributed in many countries around the world, and the Institute describes its mission as one that is, quote, rooted in the belief that AI is not inevitable, its harms are preventable, and when its production and deployment include diverse perspectives and deliberate processes, it can be beneficial. Our research reflects our lived experiences and centers our communities, end quote. Adio received his PhD in political science, and his academic work focused on critiquing techno-optimistic narratives of platform labor in sub-Saharan Africa. He spoke to us from his base in Germany. Welcome, Adio, to the Quantum Feedback Loop podcast. Really interested in hearing about the work that you're doing and the observations that you're making with your work with the Distributed AI Research Institute. Welcome.
Thank you, James. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so tell us about your work with DARE. Can you give us a sense of DARE's mission and vision and what motivated you to work with them? I understand DARE was founded 2 or 3 years ago by Timnit Gebru after she left Google. So give us a bit of background and how you got there.
Okay, so basically DARE itself is a group of or a team of distributed researchers and activists who have a strong belief in the fact that AI harms can be prevented. They are not inevitable. At the core of what we believe at DARE is we believe that as far as we can, we should always aim to minimize or end or mitigate the harms of AI. And not just that, but also to try as much as possible to promote the development of ethical AI that actually serves a purpose. Not just because we are capable of doing it. So one thing we always say is that just because an AI tool can be made does not mean it should be made. Yeah, I think that's basically what we focus on at DARE. And then personally, I come from a political science background. I've been a political activist for many years in Zimbabwe before I moved to Germany. And so for me, DARE was like that culmination of you know, when you have certain interests, basically, I have been an activist for the longest time, but now I'm an academic. So when you have that confluence of these two things, being an academic and being an activist, and DARE was just like the right space for me because we're a team of both academics and activists. So myself as an academic activist, this is like the right place to be.
So the AI harms that you mentioned, are there specific harms that gave the inspiration to DARE to start, or is it an ongoing, continuing to look at developing harms?
I think there are a lot of the AI harms that we speak of. Of course, they are the most notable ones, which include the issues of racial bias within AI systems. So most notably is the case of Portia Woodruff in the US was wrongfully identified by facial recognition software used by the police. And she was arrested, yet she was 8 months pregnant. So clearly that was an issue where there was this unfounded or this, you know, open trust in machines. Because if they had just relied on their own intelligence, they would have asked the guy, hey, did the woman who mugged you, was she pregnant? And the guy would have said, no, she was not pregnant. And case closed. But she was arrested because they said, okay, facial recognition says this. So this extends beyond, I think the story of Portia is just a practical case, but this also goes into things like hiring. Many tools have trouble recognizing darker skin tones. There are also different issues, I think, where when we talk of harm and bias, again, of course, where I like to talk about more is my own area where I really zone in on, which is the labor that is producing all of this.
Mm-hmm. And in the case with Porsche, I guess the facial recognition failed because of the darker skin tone. And these models are trained on primarily white people and white males, and so it's more prone to error. So this is, and a harm, and as you said, in hiring as well, where assumptions are being made.
Yes, I actually saw another study which was actually saying that when you type in photo generating softwares, that when you type in that I want a doctor, you almost always, or a CEO, if you say a CEO, you almost always get a middle-aged white male, because this is where these AI systems literally build on the biases that are already embedded in our society. Because in our society, this is generally the belief that a successful CEO should be white and should be a man. So AI systems simply take the same things and mirror those biases we already have in our different societies. So if you, I think the one I saw, which was, I would say it was funny, but also it was very heartbreaking, was when someone said children playing with toys in the DRC, and there were pictures of these kids playing with grenades, with bombs, you know. Because generally, what's spoken out there about the DRC is that it's a country in conflict. So the idea of a child in DRC playing with a Barbie doll is not something that you'll find on an AI system that is built on a biased data, so to speak.
And I guess it's because these data points are being taken and used indiscriminately in different situations without any sort of context, I guess is the problem. As you were saying, the DRC, the toy is very different in that context than it would be for those of us sitting in North America, for example.
In a way, but also the ignorance in or the lack of a specific data in the data sets that are being built. Because usually what, like if you look at companies like OpenAI, which you mentioned earlier, is that their modus operandi was literally, or is literally, I don't know if they've changed, I doubt it, but is scraping the internet of all of any and all the information they can get. So the internet therefore is filled with a lot of rubbish, basically. So that rubbish and those wrongful assumptions are the ones which are then built into these systems. So now when you put in a prompt, this prompt is based on inaccurate data, because remember, this data is primarily like these systems are primarily built by people. Of course, I'll get, when I say built, I literally mean the guys who are directing the things, not really the ones who are rebuilding, because we know those are from the global south. But the people who are building these, your tech bros are sitting in Silicon Valley. They have a particular worldview that they have. And when they build most of these systems, they are only relying on, they're only using data generated maybe in the global north. And therefore, they are not specific to different countries and contexts. So, in that sense, that is why, because these things took data from the internet where some random guy was saying whatever they were saying about the DRC, which is most likely inaccurate. Then, when this data, which is inaccurate already, is used to train any system, you would definitely not expect to get any realistic or accurate information there.
And machines can't filter data. People have to tell them how to filter data. So I wanted to ask you about that because I've heard you say that, many of us think of AI and machines like robots, that they'll do what we ask them to do. But you have said that there are real people behind the scenes behind those robots, and those people aren't being treated well. So can you give us some real life examples of the work that these people do, the kind of filtering work that they do, and the things that they're exposed to?
Okay. So usually when I'm talking about this, I usually start by saying we have two kinds of sets of two overwhelming or headlines, so to speak. The first one is that machines are stupid. And the second one is that people are deranged. So those are the two issues we're working with. So when I say machines are stupid, it means machines cannot tell a lie or a joke from reality. So when propaganda is spread there, a machine will not be able to say, okay, this is propaganda, because it lacks that discernment. So a machine will not be able to figure out this is a car or this is a donkey. Someone has to train a machine to say, this is a car and this is a donkey. And also, because of this, it also means a machine will not be able to tell right from wrong, ethical from unethical, or morally right from being immoral. So what then this means is that there are people who are needed to train these machines to teach them how to recognize these things. Of course, we could debate the whole idea of saying we are teaching machines, but anyway, it's called machine learning. So for now, I'll park that debate. But getting to the fact that these people, therefore, are doing this data annotation, data labeling, data cleaning, they are the people I believe are the real people powering artificial intelligence. Because without them, AI relies on data, copious amounts of data, and this data is raw and filtered. It needs someone to organize it, to clean it. And then, in addition to this, moving to the point where I said humans are deranged. I was sick in the head, whatever term you are comfortable with. It means that the worst impulses that human beings are capable of, think of the worst thing that you can think of, which you find so reprehensible. There is someone out there who's doing exactly that and posting it on the internet. So when you and I go, let's say, for example, on social media, when we go there, we see a trigger warning and a blurred screen. And we then choose whether we want to click and see what's behind that or we move forward. But there are people based in different parts of the world, mainly the global south, who, unfortunately, unlike you and me, who have the luxury of seeing the trigger warning, they are the ones who put the trigger warning. So that means they first have to see this. So you asked me to get into specifics. One example is a core researcher of ours, I spoke with in Nairobi, Kenya, who explained that they were facing what they call CSAM. Which is like a code for this kind of material. This is a code for child sexual abuse material. So basically, they were seeing the worst kind of depravity, sexual and violent depravity towards children. So this was coming in text form. Someone is going is being, a novelist writing these things, but these are not things that they are writing out of their fantasy, but out of their reality. And then there are videos of this. So basically, the people that the data workers that I'm talking about are the ones who have to go through this and read this and flag it so that you and I don't have to see it. OpenAI, ChatGPT, the people were responsible for sort of curating it and trying to prevent it from spewing racist and other like racist and other hateful stuff were based in Nairobi, Kenya. So they were the ones who were responsible to make sure that these chatbots that we use, everyone is so happy about, don't end up spewing this hate speech. Because sometimes, I don't know if you have used ChatGPT or any of these large language models. Sometimes when you try to make it say some things which are of a perverse nature, defining perverse however you want, they will tell you, I cannot participate in this. Because there were workers in Kenya specifically who were working on that project to make sure it does not do that. So these are the people I'm talking about.
And these workers who are doing this, are they given any sort of mental health? I mean, this must be really upsetting. Are they given any mental health training, support? I mean, or are they just put in front of a screen and told to filter out what they think should be filtered out?
On paper, they are given that, but in all the conversations I've heard with workers, and I've heard with these conversations with workers, plenty of them, and not just in Kenya, but almost globally. The workers that we have spoken with, one of the projects we are working on, the Data Workers Inquiry Project, and also in their own words, they are given what I would call token mental health support. So, in the words of one of our core researchers, he was saying that the people they heard were more of wellness coaches than trained counselors. So he also argued that they had no capacity, at least in his, and also I would say in their, because it's not just him, in their perception, the mental health practitioners they had did not have the sufficient expertise to be able to help them process this. So imagine when someone is describing that the mental health that we offered while doing this job was a group wellness session where we sit in a group and the counselor comes and says, okay, guys, so how are you doing? Are you doing okay? Be strong. Don't internalize this. You'll be fine. And so how are you feeling? You tell us, okay, we are fine, guys. Carry on, good job, and leaves. That's the mental health they get. So in as few words as possible, I would say they get extremely inadequate mental health support. So, and this has led to very serious consequences for many of these people.
What are examples of some of the consequences that they've suffered?
So the majority of the people I've spoken with are suffering from, of course, I'm not a psychologist myself, so I cannot exactly say I made a diagnosis. But if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's definitely not a zebra. And when you speak with someone, you can tell this person is not well, like mentally. So what I saw was PTSD clearly, but of course I'm not a medical practitioner. So this one. And then the second thing is, I don't know if you go on our website, the Data Workers Inquiry website, there is a documentary we have there, which we recorded in Nairobi. And there's one young man there who explains that he suffered from erectile dysfunction as a result of taking in copious amounts of child molestation. And at the end of the day, his wife left him. And I spoke to at least four people whose wives left them because their behavior has changed. So one said, again, it's in this documentary, which I'm talking about. One was arguing that, was not arguing, but stating that he became violent and they had to actually leave Nairobi, the capital city, and go and try to live in the countryside where there are fewer people. The other one had would have would just wake up in the middle of the night screaming. So many have attempted suicide. Some even have. If you are familiar with another documentary released a couple of years back called The Cleaners, some actually they are actually cases of people committing suicide in front of their computers because they cannot cope with this and psychological help that is coming is inadequate. So many of these people were left, I would say, mentally damaged, and they also did not have any money for their trouble. So you are left broken and broke. So you are destroyed in every facet you can think about. And then again, if we had focused on Kenya, we also have cases of people who were taken from different countries to work for these outsourcing companies in Kenya. And at the end of the day, they were dismissed and they did not even have enough money to go home. So I think what I would also want to maybe to add on to this question that you asked is when we also start understanding how these workers who work behind the scenes of AI, like who are they? So we have a case in Kenya, for example, where refugees fleeing the conflict in Tigray. So these were Tigray people, Tigrayans who speak Tigrinya, where their region was under siege from both the government forces as well as the Eritrean government forces. So they were caught between two armies. And these people fled to Nairobi, Kenya, and sought refuge there. And as I said, that machines are stupid. They are not able to filter content to identify hate speech. Someone has to do that work. So these are refugees running away from Tigray, Ethiopia, were then recruited to moderate content on the same war they ran away from. And there was a blockade, like physical and internet-wise. So they had no idea what was happening to their people they had left behind, those who could not flee, which meant the next picture you could possibly see on your screen could be your father or your brother or your sister. And you are reading this hate speech directed towards your own people. And because you are the only one who can speak that language, so you are hired for that language skill. So I'm sure you can appreciate the level of traumatization these people went through. You have run away from a war, you're already traumatized by that. You have left behind your loved ones and probably everything that you ever owned. Now you're in a new country and you get a job, which forces you to review content which you ran away from. And guess what? You can't quit because your residence in that card is in that country is tied to your job. So if you quit this job, then leave, but leave and go where? So now you just have to continue and do this work.
It's hard to imagine. It really is hard to imagine. And what do these jobs pay? What are these people earning?
There was an article, I think by Perigio, which said they were earning about $2 an hour. I spoke to these workers and they were like, actually, it's less than $1 an hour. And I've seen payslips to this effect. So these are not just claims I'm making that they make less than $1 an hour. I've seen payslips. So basically, let's say the range is from slightly under $2 to less than $1. This is the range per hour of how much they are paid.
Yeah, and as you say, a lot of them just cannot leave. They're tied to the job.
Exactly. And also, I think another aspect also is who are these people against? People, who are these people? I spoke about one side, which are the refugees, but the others are also. So if you go to Kenya, you realize most of the people who work in these jobs are from the slums. So these are people already who were not born with a silver spoon, if any spoon at all in their mouths. And therefore, they are trying to get out, from these terrible living conditions. And the only job which is there, and of course, I cannot make this bold claim because I did not verify it. But from the people that I spoke with, they actually argued that there was actually a systemic way of recruiting which targeted people from these areas. So the person, one of the people I spoke with, said that I tried applying with my actual address. I could not get the job. I changed my address to one of the slums and I got the job. So you are already desperate. So you accept anything.
And how many people? So you mentioned Nairobi specifically. So how many people in Nairobi? And then I wanted to talk maybe about other locations as well. But in Nairobi, for example, if that's a big center, how many people would be working on this data filtering, putting trigger warnings, watching these horrible things?
We're talking of per company, we're talking of something like 3,000 to 5,000.
And that's just in Nairobi.
This is just Nairobi. So, and mind, in Nairobi, there are a couple of companies which do this. So it's not just one company. There are a couple of companies. So these people are not only content moderators. I think I have to also clarify that. They're not only content moderators, they are also data annotators. But these are basically the people involved in the whole AI supply chain. We have South Africa, Cape Town. We have Gulu in Uganda. And I'm still to follow up, but I heard there's another center in Ghana. So what I got, the feeling I got from my research is that whenever there is heat, so to speak, in one country, they move to the next country. So now from what I figured, they are in about four countries and there are still 50 countries to go if they are to round all of Africa.
And I think you've said that this is a problem primarily in the global south. I guess it's a function of wealth and where they can get the lowest wages, right? Now, is this mainly centered in Africa or does it go across the world?
So from our research, it's mainly a global South problem, but not exclusively, because we have met workers who are doing this work based in Germany. They are people based from, yeah, basically all over the world. So in the US, there are also people working on Amazon, Mechanical Turk. They do similar work to this, but perhaps maybe not so much as the content moderation, but more of the annotation and labeling. But there are also people who do this work in the USA and other countries. So in our project, for example, we are actually working with people from six different countries. We have people from Lebanon, Syria, Venezuela, Brazil, which are the countries that I live out, Kenya, those are countries. So you see that. So and but however, what you will see from all of these people, wherever they you find them, whether it's in the global south or the global north, they usually share one thing, which is these are people in precarious conditions, manifesting in different ways. For example, the ones in Germany are Syrian, Iranian refugees or asylum seekers. So already their options are somewhat limited to what they can do. So this is usually how this works.
And so you said it's, I guess, two main functions. I think you're saying the content moderation, that's where the trigger warnings are being put on and the horrible visuals and written material is being dealt with. And then the data labeling, which is, taking pictures of cats in many poses and writing cat on it, right? And so, I mean, there was that horrible problem with Google back in, was it 2018, where it labeled two black people as gorillas. And of course, they've tried to backtrack and make sure that anything now labeled as gorillas is very carefully monitored. But that's just one example of these problems with data labeling. So is this whole issue really just based on our hunger for data and the need to get some sort of automation of all of this data? And this is what's really giving rise to the problems for the workers on both the moderation and the labeling?
I would say yes to a larger extent because as I explained earlier, for AI to develop, it needs copious amounts of data. So the more things we try to automate, the more things we try to have some chatbot or some AI functionality on, it means the more data we need. Because like I said, it needs the AI tool is itself or AI in itself is a machine. Is stupid. A machine cannot tell color. It cannot tell whether something is dry or wet. So which means we need all of that to say this is a cat and this cat is dry and this cat is wet and it's pink, it's gray, whatever. So all of those little details need to be fed into this system. So the more powerful this machine has to be able to generate a range of prompt or a range of results from different prompts, is the more data it needs, and also the more energy it needs, which is another aspect of this whole AI development. So
For
this
sure, yeah.
constant need of new data each and every day is what then pushes. Sometimes there's a paper which actually came out a few days ago. Antonio Casilli posted it, which was actually rubbishing the whole idea that AI can generate its own data. And you know, because I've heard these questions in several places where I'm told, but what if AI gets so powerful that it can now generate its own training data and we no longer need these people? And I've said, maybe that will happen, but not now and not in the near future.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is to this. I mean, who are the major consumers of these services? Like, is it OpenAI that's buying this data filtering moderation? Is it Facebook? Who are the major buyers for these services?
All of those you mentioned. So almost every big tech company you can think of, and other not so well-known tech firms. So how I would explain this is, I would say, think of any company that is doing any form of AI or automation in like any process that involves that in their consumer. So I remember having a conversation with one of the data workers in Kenya. And they say to me that, oh, you live in Germany. I'm like, yeah. They're like, oh, which city? Then I told them, they're like, oh, it's near Hamburg. I'm like, yeah. They were like, well, I know Hamburg more than you do. And they started explaining that, you know, I know the streets and this feature. And how? Because they were working for a company based in Germany, which is into trying to make driverless cars. So they need to automate, like to label the whole street so that the car can be able to move easily. So that means those companies are trying to create driverless vehicles. They are consumers of this data labeling and the annotation cleaning, whatever. So those and any other you can think of, the ones we are trying to do editing of what's called grammar editing, picture editing, photo editing, whatever. All of these companies that you see, the moment a company comes to you and says, at the click of a button, just know they are consuming data from somewhere. They are buying this data.
Is there any indication of the total dollar value or the monetary size of this data market, the market for buying content moderation and labeling?
I wouldn't place a number on this, but I would hazard that this actually could spread into the trillions of dollars, not just billions, because think of any company that you need, and these companies okay, they are valued in the billions, not necessarily making billions, as reports are starting to filter out that these AI companies are not making any profits. But the fact that all these companies are valued in the billions, then that is probably, if we're to make an assumption, this is where the market for this could also go.
And is there any, do any of these companies have any sort of internal policies to ensure or to try to treat workers fairly or to make sure that they're not confronted with the worst things without any sort of support? Or is there any sort of international standards developing in that sense?
All of these companies claim that they are ethical companies, that whatever they are doing is above board. So all of them claim. Sama, one of the major outsourcing companies in which is operating in different countries, but specifically in Kenya, a San Francisco registered company. They actually claim to be an ethical company, and they were non-profit, just like our favorite AI company. They were also non-profit, but now who knows? So they all claim that they are ethical in whatever they are doing. But are they? I don't think they are at all. Because whatever they claim or whatever they say, because I've spoken with people from different companies, so it's not just one company, but the different companies. So whatever they say and what they do are not the same thing. So they all, but there are some companies like Humans in the Loop, which operates mainly in the Middle East. They are, because they are a social enterprise, so they also have their own set of code of ethics and different value systems. Do they live up to these? Your guess as good as mine.
I'm wondering in, I mean, I guess when you started this research, you probably expected some of this. What would you say would be the most surprising finding you've made so far? The most unexpected, shocking, maybe good? I don't know. Is there anything that particularly stands out in the research that you didn't expect when you went into this?
I think so. I would say that I more or less had an idea of what was happening, but what I discovered when I went there was the gravity of it. So I had an idea that there was worker exploitation, but what I did not know was the depth to which this exploitation was happening. So I knew the people would see dangerous content and then they put labels on it or they put trigger warnings, but I did not understand just how dirty we are talking when it comes to the stuff they get to see every day. Just how harmful that was. I did not get to understand this until we started doing this research. And also, before I traveled to Kenya to speak to people on the ground, whatever I also thought I understood changed very much when I went on the ground. And I'm talking to people and I'm moving and looking at where they live and where they stay. So I think another one thing I would say probably was surprising in all of this was for me how all of this seems to be coordinated. Like all this exploitation, it's not isolated incidents where you say, okay, this company is a bad actor, so they are doing this, but this one is better. It seems like, so you seem to get this feeling of someone somewhere controlling everything that is happening, like setting standards of basically bad behavior, that these guys, this is how low we can sink, let's go. So one of the core researchers that we actually worked with made the same observation and said they're working for one company called Cloud Factory. Then they don't like the conditions there. Then they left and joined Summer. And they said they found out some of the projects they're working on in one company were also present in the other company. So as if these companies would like give each other work, you know. Of course, we cannot confirm this to say that's what they were doing. But this is the perception that we seem to get from this. Yeah. And also, I
Interesting.
think for me, another thing also was the whole idea that in this recruitment, whenever they're in a country, that country is simply the base, but people are actually recruited from different countries and then put up in this warehouse where they have to go. I didn't know that people would literally be recruited. I would think maybe you just happen to find yourself in this country, but no. The company would actually go to your country and say, hey, we have a job for you. Come with us. Let's go to Nairobi. Let's go to Uganda. And then there already you've been taken away from your home, from your comfort zone. And then you get there and then you start going through these things.
And are the different countries, are the laws in the different countries, do they treat this work differently? Does the legal system of Kenya, for example, provide any sort of protection to these workers?
There's a German word I like very much. It's called Jein, which is yes and no. So there are laws, there are labor laws in Kenya and in many of these African countries. But you see, the thing with digital labor is that the progress being made on the digital labor front is faster than the change in regulation. So some of these workers suffer from a problem where there is a mischaracterization of who they are because the systems in place are not yet ready to deal with workers like this. I remember on a research trip in Rwanda, I asked one government official if they are thinking of decent work in the digital labor landscape. And he said, no, our focus is on labor, on getting jobs. So we're not talking about regulating before we have the jobs. I, of course, disagree, but this I found is the common understanding among many African countries. Kenya, you asked specifically. They're very happy that these companies are situated in Kenya and recruiting and hiring Kenyan young people. So to many of these governments in Africa, they look at the number of people being employed, and that's what matters, not necessarily the quality of employment. So an example is in Kenya, when these workers were trying to form a union, it was problematic to say what union do they join. So they wanted to form their own, but they were told, no, go and join the Postal and Telecommunications Workers Union. So now you have someone who does this work being in the same union with a postman or a postwoman. Do you see how already we have a problem there in terms of how do we coalesce and fight for our rights? Because whatever someone who gets to look at child molestation videos every day and someone who gets to deliver mail, there are problems. Yes, of course, as workers, we all have the same problems against capitalism, but the way they manifest is largely different. So, to a large extent, the laws that are in place, but they are not to a sufficient enough level to protect the workers. The Kenyan courts ruled, for example, in the matter against Meta and Sama, that they ruled in favor of the workers. But these companies still protested that the ruling, because what happened was when these workers were, about 250 economy moderators were fired by Sama, and then they took Sama to court, and then Sama said, no, we are not, you're not our employees. And then Meta's employees, Meta is like, no, you're not our employees. So that's, remember what I said earlier, that what I then discovered was seeming like there's a coordinated effort to exploit people, because there was this plausible deniability where these ones were saying, no, you do not work for us. Of course, the Kenyan court made a ruling which was actually a landmark ruling to say, no, you guys are actually employed by Meta. Sama is simply an agent of Meta. But still, it's not like it yielded anything. The case is still pending, and Meta and Sama are both fighting the case.
Yeah, responsibility. It's I guess it's easy to hide when you're subcontracting these services, and
Clearly.
how do you, so I guess do these companies, whether it's Meta with Facebook or Google or any of the other companies that are buying these data content moderation labeling services, do they have similar standards, like in terms of telling the workers, this is acceptable, but below it's not acceptable, and we use the same gray zones in terms of or is there a whole range of different standards being applied?
I wouldn't give a definitive answer to that because I haven't made a specific study to really understand that. But what I've seemed to see is it seems like because the when you talk to the workers from these different companies, they seem to be going through the same things. That's why I say it seems like there's a someone somehow or somewhere or some board somewhere coordinating these standards. So it's very similar, like the how these workers are exploited across different companies. And be it in Germany, you have workers complaining about similar issues to the workers in the global south. Only problem, only good thing, of course, is if you are in a country like Germany, the labor laws, they are more developed and more advanced, so you have the law to fall back on. But there are other problems like victimization if you dare speak out. Those exist everywhere. Union busting tactics, these exist everywhere. Amazon Mechanical Turk, Amazon itself is doing the same thing. So all of these, Google as well. So it just seems like, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist because I'm not, definitely, but I just can't shake that feeling to say, is there some body controlling how this exploitation happens? It's like they've standards of exploitation.
I guess, and there's a lot of money, as you say, that's involved in it. So, how have you, just a large overall question, how have you seen the evolution of ethical considerations in AI developing to this point? I mean, I guess there was the very public departure of Timnit from Google,
From Google,
and that was 3 years ago, or no, 4 years ago, maybe now, almost. So there was obviously that flashpoint. How have things evolved before then and since then, and kind of where do we stand now with the whole matter?
I think if we were to speak on the evolution of this, we'd say I think initially it was an issue of like where the focus was mainly on the potential benefits of AI. So it was a very optimistic view of AI. And then as we moved on, so for example, with the firing of Timnit from Google that you mentioned, then we saw sort of this whole ethical move starting to be more critical, starting to raise issues to do with things like bias, privacy concerns, and potential misuse. And currently, while that debate or those questions are still very much relevant and still being contested and discussed and debated, now you also see a move more towards this AI governance, transparency, and more or less long-term societal impacts of AI. So I think this is how we have moved from a position of being very optimistic and thinking how we can manifest the benefits and not talking about the negatives at all. But now we are there where now, which is why we are now seeing many governments as well as bodies like the EU coming up with AI acts and things like this. So it's more at a, I would say, at a what's called an AI governance sort of level.
Right. Yeah. And I guess, from my own experience, I mean, I've, been following the story for many years, but I find that the public discourse really took off, I guess, when OpenAI issued ChatGPT, the first version of it. And then all of a sudden there was this global conversation about, wow, there's this incredible power here. And then all sorts of lawsuits now developing about, use of private works without compensation and all of this, which I guess that kind of ties into what you're saying about the governance question, where it's at now. Yeah. How do you see DARE's mission in this? Like, where's the most benefit to the public going to come from DARE's mission?
So I think in all of this, there, of course, because Tim Neath is the founder and executive director of DARE, which also means that the main issues that he's been focusing on, which is basically around bias and marginalization, is where DARE's mission or direction is rooted on. So in this debate that we're talking about, we see that DARE's main focus is primarily on the inclusion of marginalized voices in this whole debate, both marginalized voices as researchers and as well as developers of different AI tools. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is also studying the societal impacts of AI. So in different contexts, which is why, for instance, we have this Data Workers Inquiry project, which is focusing on studying the societal impacts of AI development across the globe. So we're looking at the workers who are involved in this, as well as the bigger issues to their communities. And so the third thing, I think also speaking on the issue of marginalization, I think it's also the issue of trying to have as many people from as many diverse backgrounds as possible on the table to talk about this. So, for example, our name is right there in the name, distributed. So the distributed aspect actually focused on that. So we have team members from pretty much all over the place. So we have people in Germany, Kenya, Uganda, Canada. So that whole aspect is also that idea of saying we also not just need the researchers to be based in the global north, but we also need the researchers to be based in the different communities that are impacted by these issues, which is also why the researchers we worked with in the different places that I'm talking about for our Data Workers Inquiry project, they were not our research participants, they were our core researchers. So they were the ones who were talking to their own communities, not us jetting into their countries and conducting interviews. Yes, we also went to some of these centers to sort of support the work they were doing, but we believe that the communities and the local experts are the experts of their own stories. And also, even in our output of this project, it was the workers or the core researchers themselves who were writing the output, not us. We were just support staff. So this is where I think DARE fits in very well in in this whole debate on ethics. In that we are saying, no, let's have as many diverse voices as possible on the table.
And that's the benefit of discussions like this, to raise public awareness. So you mentioned the Data Workers Inquiry Project. Is that something that's going to be released publicly? Is it already out there? I'm just wondering, how we can raise public awareness.
No, thank you for the issue of public awareness. And I'm actually happy, which is why I'm very happy that we're having this conversation. Because as I always mention, that the reason why many of these workers are being exploited is because this exploitation happens in darkness. Very few people know this what's happening. So the Data Workers Inquiry Project is actually out there already. It was launched last month. So we have a website where people can go and read or watch or listen, depending on what you like. Because what we were doing with this project is that it was focusing on understanding the working conditions of data workers across the globe. And the mode of output we chose for this project was where the core researchers, who are the workers themselves, will determine the best medium they want to communicate their results. So some would say, hey, I like talking. So there's a vlog where someone was doing a vlog. They say they're a comic strip. They are animations, documentary, reports. So depending on what you like as a consumer or as someone who's interested in these topics, you'll find something that is in exactly the medium that you like. So in addition to that, we are also hosting a talk series based on that, where the same workers or core researchers who were involved in this then come in and we sit with them, and they also get to talk, and the audience can also get to ask them questions. So essentially, it's the workers talking about their own experiences in their own words.
Yeah, and important to tell those stories in the way that they're comfortable telling them, I guess, is
Precisely, precisely.
yeah.
So, which is why it was mainly them responsible for choosing the medium. Our role was simply to say, okay, you want to write a booklet. Okay, we have the expertise in how this is done. You go ahead and tell us what's your plan. We assist you. You want to record a podcast. Okay, we can assist with the recording and the editing, but how the format, it's your baby.
Right. And then I guess there's, I'm reading there's a couple of other projects, possible futures, translation tool. You could just tell us a little bit about those.
Okay, so I'll start with the translation. So this is Lesan.ai, where our colleague Asmelash is focusing on that. So the idea behind this lesson is that the idea is about as you said, translation. So the main idea behind this project is to say that we are trying to fight misinformation, fake news. And how do we do this? One of the main or the primary or the earliest points of focus is that these things, misinformation and fake information, happen because people don't have enough information. So if you can't access the internet, or if the internet is present but not in your language, then it means you then have to rely on someone else telling you whatever they think. And we all know that when we do that, then the broken telephone scenario happens. Someone tells you what they want. So its main focus of this translation is on Ethiopian languages, because the idea is to try and focus on the largest population, then moving down, but the most unserved. Because this translation tool is actually better, based on, not because this is our project, but actually based on independent reviewers. Its translation for Ethiopian languages, Tigrinya, Amharic, is actually better than what Google has in the same languages. That's
Interesting.
the translation. And then the Possible Future series. So Possible Future series is, as I explained, that our focus is there is to try and minimize, mitigate, prevent AI harms, but also to promote the development of ethical AI. So the Possible Future series is where we then say, hey, this is not going on well, right? We don't like what's going on, and we will call it out, as we endeavor to always do whenever we see exploitation happening or harmful tools being made. However, we're not stopping at criticizing or calling out harmful things. We take a step further and say, what does a possible future look like? So we have heard the first article on the Possible Futures series was asking the question, what does internet for my grandmother look like? So she has zero computer skills, but we also want her to be on the internet, because there's an African proverb which says the death of an old person is like the burning down of a library. So our old people are dying, and they can't feed their indigenous knowledge on the internet because they can't access it. So we are then imagining, what does the internet for our grandmothers look like? So that was one. The other one was talking about how can we make sure education, quality education, reaches as many people as possible. So we had the bus model of education on the Possible Future series. So we were trying to say, okay, sometimes education does not have to be as linear like the way it is, where you have to go to school from the first grade up to whatever PhD. But what if it would be like a bus? When you get on a bus, you get on the bus wherever you want to get on the bus, and you ride to wherever you want to go based on your needs. So what if we could shape education like that? but make this available on the internet, because it's we are a tech company, so our solutions have to be more or less in tech. And the forthcoming article will be focusing on issues of refugees, refugee crisis. Many refugees are going missing in the Sahara Desert, in the Mediterranean, and their families left in the Middle East, in Africa. We have no idea what happened to their loved ones. So what if we could use technology to help us bridge that gap where they know what happened to their people? If they drowned the Mediterranean, they will know, okay, and get closure. If they died in the Sahara Desert, or if they're being exploited as slaves in Libya, at least they have that closure. That way we know, okay, we can stop searching now. We can begin officially mourning now because our person is dead. Or okay, they're still alive somewhere. So that's what the possible future series is focusing on.
Interesting. Yeah, really positive work.
And I think what I also have to stress about the possible futures is that this is not science fiction or imaginary. We're actually trying to zone in and say, okay, what does this look like? So if we're talking of an internet that serves the need of people with visual impairments, what does this look like? So essentially, the idea at the end of the day is to actually promote development of whatever solutions that we propose on the on there. So we are not just focusing on the fictitious or a utopia. So we actually, one of the core requirements for that is actually to say whatever solution you are bringing on the possible futures has to be realistic. Don't tell us about invading Mars and going to live in Mars. I think those who want to go to Mars, we know people like Elon Musk, they can go and probably if they can take a one-way ticket, that'll be okay.
And so, in terms of DARE's work, if the public wants to support DARE's work, how do they do that?
We'll be very happy if the public wants to support DARE's work. So there are two main, I think, issues, or they could be increased to three, which I think the public can support our work. The first one is, of course, everything that we do needs money. So money is the most, not outside, say the most important, but is a very key component of doing this work. For example, the workers that we worked with, the core researchers for in this project, in the different project that we're working on, not just the Data Workers Inquiry, but all the projects that we work on, we focus on making sure that we compensate each and every person that we work with at rates which are equivalent to if they were based in Europe, in the USA, wherever we are based. So that requires a lot of money, and we'll be very happy for any financial support. On our website, the DARE website, how people can help is very clear. On the Data Workers Inquiry project, it's so very clear on how people can click with easy click, they can be able to support us financially. The second thing, of course, is getting our work out there, publicizing our work and letting people know what we are doing. So we believe that if we can get this work that we are doing, these different projects that we're working on out there, the Social Media Harms project, the Spatial Apartheid project, the translation, the Workers Inquiry, the wage theft, and all of these projects that we're working on at DARE, if many people could know about them and raise as much awareness as possible. So we are very happy to be invited to podcasts. We're very happy to be asked to contribute written articles to newspapers, TV interviews, all of that. I think these are the different ways that I think we can get support. And also the public sharing our stuff. So this podcast, if they can share it with as many people as possible, we are available on social media as well, on Twitter and on these different platforms. So we'll be very happy for that awareness. I would say I think those two are the main ones, the main areas where we can get support.
Yeah, and that is key, as you say, to ensure that the people doing the work are properly compensated. And I guess, too, is there a way, for anybody listening to this who shares some of the concerns that I've developed after listening to what you've been explaining, can anybody listening to this, is there anything they can do to the consumers of this data content moderation and labeling services? Do we have a way of saying anything to those people to say, listen, maybe should you consider some standards? Should you consider doing things differently? Is there any power that the users or the end users like me and the listeners have?
I believe, yes, we do. It's just similar to where we've seen things like Black Diamonds and Fair Work Standards and things like that. I believe at an individual level, we can also start being critical and conscious of how we use different AI tools, so or platforms. So if we are going to be going on Facebook or Meta, is now called, or Twitter X, How do we have that critical view now of what goes on behind the scenes? When we are using, let's say, some photo editing software or photo generating software, when we know that this is using the stolen work of artists without compensating them. So as individual level, I think we can start by choosing to look for the artist and pay them instead of going to this tool which was built by stealing from the workers and then without compensating them anything and using that. So if we could start by that, taking that stance in terms of how we use it, being more conscious of what we use and how we use it, and if we could also start demanding for better. And I understand many people who will be listening to us now, they belong to different countries or jurisdictions, and they have their political representatives there. So if they can start talking to their local political rep to say, hey, we demand standards, because most of these companies are from the global north anyway. So if there is a Canadian company which is taking this data, if in Canada we can be more critical and say, we are not going to allow a company which exploits workers in the global south to thrive in Canada without them putting in place very clear guidelines on how they're going to compensate. So that could be another thing that we could do. One thing I've found in this is that workers working in the global north are compensated differently from those working in the global south. So if we could start raising those issues and raise those concerns, I think that's what people who are listening now could do. And demanding to say, we are not going to be buying or to be using ChatGPT unless there is transparency in who are the people who are working behind the scenes. How much are they being compensated? Are they getting mental health support? If the company cannot pass that minimum threshold, then it does not deserve our support. And I think also if we could start listening or giving more prominence, I would say, to more critical thinkers or more critical in their assessment of AI and less to AI hypists who are always talking about how AI is going to be doing many, many great things. But till now, we haven't. Okay, of course. So I think I need to make this clear because someone once accused me of being a Luddite. And I need to make it very clear that I am not a Luddite. I don't believe that we need to destroy data centers or AI systems. But I think we need to be very critical of how we perceive them. Let's not be AI hypists and believe that AI is some god or a panacea to all our problems. It's not. Let's be very realistic about what it can do and what it cannot do. Let's think about the massive energy consumption that is needed to keep powering these large language models. Let's think about the workers who are being found in different parts of the world being exploited. And say, let's let them get compensation. If a company is using this much energy and releasing this much CO2, what are the mitigating factors? How is it mitigating? Is it planting trees somewhere? So that it's an actual work, not just greenwashing. So I think if we start asking these questions and demanding these things and countering and challenging these tech bros, because if we keep quiet, they get away with murder. I've listened to Sam Altman, I've listened to Elon Musk speaking. And most of the times I have my mouth wide open because they are spewing so much stuff that is unrealistic or that is downright lies. But no one is challenging them. So if we start focusing our attention on critical thinkers and critical people and less on people who stand to benefit either way from this system.
And as you say, transparency is key. You know, if there was disclosure so that, you know, if, for example, people using Facebook knew how much energy was being used to prepare those images that are being consumed on the screen, or how many workers were behind the scenes filtering that data, maybe people would understand that some change is required. Or as you say, to speak to the lawmakers to ensure that there's some sort of consistent standard. Yeah.
Definitely.
Does the EU's AI Act, is that a signal for some sort of upcoming maybe legislation or movement to deal with this problem that's going on behind the scenes?
I would say to an extent, yes. It's a fairly decent initial attempt at trying to tame this beast, so to speak. And yeah, I think we'll see many more such acts being developed as time moves on. And again, we need to be also to be very critical about any AI tool that is developed. I think I read recently, a few days ago, that in the US, the same tech bros I've been talking about, whose names I've been mentioning, are saying, no, we need to form some form of AI regulatory board. And I'm like, yeah, of course. I mean, the hyena is a very good candidate for being elected into the vegan committee, you know. So we need to push back against that, because we cannot have the leader of an AI company saying they want to sit on the board of to regulate themselves. Where has that happened?
Yeah, and I guess the facial recognition problem that you started by talking about, I mean, that's one that I think the EU's AI Act is going some distance to dealing with that in terms of what's acceptable and what's absolutely not acceptable. But yeah, I guess it's a question of standards have to start somewhere, and hopefully discussions like this and DARE's work will really bring the issue to the forefront. And I really want to thank you for your time here and taking us behind the scenes of something that we just don't see, but we just simply take for granted what's on the screen, but we don't realize what's behind that. And so I think you've really explained the real human dimension behind the technology. And as you say, AI is not a panacea. I guess it's the humans behind it that is key, and we can't forget them.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure having this conversation with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Adio. And we, really look forward to hearing more about DARE's work.
Thank you very much, James.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise.
Our thanks go to today's guest and to you for listening to the Quantum Feedback Loop. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out The Quantum Record at thequantumrecord.com. The Quantum Record is a monthly journal of philosophy, science, technology, and time, where you'll find the latest developments in our rapidly evolving technological world.